You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we check in on the state of immigration policy in the U.S. amid announcements by the president involving mass deportations.
First, pet stores in Wisconsin could face fines for selling dogs and cats. That's if a new bill became law. The goal would be to shut off a sales outlet for inhumane puppy mills.
Representative Lakeisha Myers from Wisconsin's 12th Assembly District is the author of the bill. Representative Myers, thank you for joining us on Central Time.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Can you please describe for us how this legislation you've proposed would go into effect? How would it work on a practical level?
I think it works well on a practical level. We want to, you know, protect the animals that we have. You know, we don't want to see puppy mills, you know, occurring and also having animals sold. We want to use shelter animals as much as possible. So I think this is kind of like the final step. I know there was legislation that passed many years ago that kind of banned puppy mills, but we saw that people were using utilizing pet stores as a pass-through, if you will, to kind of get around that that aspect. I thought that this legislation would be something that would kind of end that practice, hopefully. So that's why we're looking at the collaborative aspect of ensuring that pet stores work with the humane societies, and certified, you know, shelters that know that they're not selling the animals but doing adoptions in their stores. So it's not taking away business from them, because you still have, you know, pet supplies and things like that that will be sold by the store. They just will not be able to sell the actual physical animals anymore.
And Representative Myers, several other states have either enacted or are considering similar legislation. Have you talked with lawmakers in those other states? What have you learned from them?
I have spoken with lawmakers in other states, the state of California. We've also looked at legislation that was looked at in New York, the state of Maryland also. So it has been working in other states. There were some issues, I think, in California with, again, looking at it as a loophole. People were still being able to, utilize dogs from puppy mills, and, you know, they had to go back and kind of look at some of the language that they had in their statute in California, and we did not want to make that same mistake here in Wisconsin. So we have been in contact with all of the major groups that deal with this, such as the Humane Society of the United States, Wisconsin's own Humane Society, and as well as the ASPCA. So we wanted to make sure that this was, you know, something that would be amicable to all groups, to make sure that this is not something that we're just doing on our own. We actually got consensus and input from a lot of different entities before we entered into this, because I know how important that, you know, the care for animals is, and especially, you know, with folks who are pet owners, you know, they're part of your family. So you want to make sure that you're looking out for their best interest.
Certainly, I don't think anybody would defend puppy mills and bad breeding and raising conditions for animals. Is there any concern that there may be ethical breeders who are going to be kind of locked out of having a direct way to sell their animals to the public?
I don't think so. I don't think it would diminish that aspect at all. You know, this was really geared toward the stores and, you know, how much is the doggy in the window type situation. So I think, you know, with ethical breeders who are breeding for, you know, a specific purpose, like we often talk about show dogs, if you will, for, you know, who are on television or things like that. I think, you know, that's not the market that we're looking for. We're looking for everyday, you know, family pets, domesticated animals that will be, you know, in your home or mine.
We're talking with Representative Lakeisha Myers. She's a Democrat from Wisconsin's 12th Assembly District, which includes Milwaukee. She is the author of a bill that would prevent the sale of dogs and cats in pet stores. And Representative Myers, if the legislation passes, what would success look like to you?
Success would look like to me that, you know, we have more adoptions going on in collaboration with our shelters and pet stores that are in our state. We don't have very many independent pet stores across our state anymore. A lot of them have given way to your major companies like Petco and PetSmart. So I think the collaborative effort is something that is good. It would drive people into the pet stores more. So I think it would also help, the pet store industry would help them as well. So I think it's a win-win for both entities.
And how would this law be enforced? Who would be responsible for making sure that pets are not being sold?
Absolutely. Well, we already have provisions in place where, we have folks that go around and do inspections to make sure that this takes place. So Define is something that I thought put teeth into our bill. So with looking at that, it would be a higher fine for breaking this law once it becomes law, hopefully. So I think that is looking at like $25,000 if you break, or repeatedly break, the law to do this. So I think it will have pet store owners thinking twice about trying to disobey what would become law.
And where does the bill stand right now? What kind of support are you seeing for it?
I'm seeing a lot of support from both sides of the aisle. We are consistently talking about the bill. A lot of different advocacy groups have, reached out to my office as well as other offices saying that they support the legislation and that they are hoping to get a committee hearing soon.
And briefly, before we let you go, if the legislation does become law or maybe if it doesn't, are you considering any other policymaking when it comes to regulating the pet industry and improving pet breeding standards?
I have not gone that far. I'm really focused on this one right now. But I think, that may be something we look at in the future. But we're looking at going one step at a time.
Well, Representative Myers, thank you so much for taking the time today. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Representative Lakeisha Myers of Wisconsin's 12th District talking about the bill that she's authored that would ban the sale of dogs and cats in pet stores. For more on the topic, we're going to bring in Mike Bober now. He's president and CEO of the Pet Industry Joint Advisory Council. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much, Judith. I appreciate you having me.
Well, tell us a little bit first, what does the Pet Industry Joint Advisory Council do?
Sure. We represent all aspects of the responsible pet care community, breeders and distributors of animals, retailers, food and product manufacturers, and service providers as well. Basically, anybody who helps you bring an animal into your home and then care for that animal once it's part of your family.
And you heard Representative Myers talk about her bill for here in Wisconsin. What's your initial response to that proposed legislation?
Well, I want to start by commending Representative Myers for wanting to address the issue of responsible breeding. It's an important issue. It's something that all of us should care about. Unfortunately, the approach that she's chosen with a pet sale ban really just isn't the appropriate way to go, and it's going to have some unintended consequences that are going to be borne primarily by small Wisconsin businesses.
Tell us more about that. What are those consequences?
Well, in California, which Representative Myers mentioned, we've already seen half a dozen stores that did sell puppies go out of business just since the new law went into effect in January. And the reason being that if a pet store is set up on a business model that relies on the sale of animals, you simply can't flip a switch and get them to the point where they can be profitable under a new model. The animals that are coming in represent not only the point of entry for customers, but also the beginning of a lifelong care relationship. And that's what our folks want to be. They want to be partners in pet care. But when you take that away, or when you force someone to change to a new model, what we've seen is that actually ends up becoming a drain on resources. There are examples on the East Coast of stores in New Jersey and Pennsylvania that have voluntarily switched to this model, and even so have still found it that they were unable to make a profit to remain viable as a for-profit entity by offering animals for adoption. They were either forced to transition to a nonprofit status like a shelter or a rescue or simply go out of business.
And the puppy mill issue is talked about a fair amount, but do we have a sense of what kind of scope of a problem this is? How many and where are these puppy mills doing their business?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that, because I think that's really one of the biggest misconceptions that drive ban efforts. When people talk about wanting to prevent the sale of dogs from puppy mills, they rely on you kind of closing your eyes and coming up with a mental image of just a horrible, horrible situation. Dogs in stacked cages with matted fur, covered in ticks, things that you and I know to be just absolutely deplorable. But the reality is those breeders are already operating illegally. And in fact, the kind of breeders that you picture when someone says puppy mill are not legally permitted to sell to pet stores in the first place. The only breeders that can sell to pet stores are USDA licensed or USDA exempt breeders who are subject to oversight and inspection.
So where are those puppies, and I assume probably kittens and other animals as well, that are being bred in these mills? Where are they being sold then?
Well, what we find is that there's actually a thriving black market for animals that are offered to the public through roadside sales, through Craigslist ads, and other online sources that don't have transparency or traceability. This tends to be where a lot of people end up going, and in fact, where they're driven even more frequently when a ban goes into effect. Across the country, only about 4% of all dogs that end up in someone's home each year are acquired in a pet store. And in a state like Wisconsin, I believe that number is even smaller because, as Representative Myers said, you have so few independent businesses in Wisconsin that are still offering dogs for sale in their retail stores.
Mike Bober is with us from the Pet Industry Joint Advisory Council. We're talking about legislation that would penalize pet stores in Wisconsin for selling dogs and cats.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this legislation? Do you have an experience where you bought a dog or cat from a pet store or from another source? Did you track down, I guess, the provenance of that animal? Were you concerned that it may have come from a mill operating illegally, illicitly? Call in at 800-642-1234. If you work in the pet business yourself, at a store, as a breeder, as a trainer, definitely love to hear your experience as well. 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation about proposed legislation that would penalize Wisconsin pet stores for selling cats and dogs. Mike Bober from the Pet Industry Joint Advisory Council is with us.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this legislation, good idea or not? Do you work at an animal rescue or shelter and have thoughts about this legislation? Where do you go when you're looking to buy a dog or cat? Where have you gone in the past? What concerns do you have about how they're bred and raised? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And let's go to the phones right now. And Cindy in Appleton is up. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. Well, I think this is a good idea because those cats and dogs that are in those pens at the pet shops are those kennels are so small and they get no interaction and they're stressed out the way it is because they're not in an environment with, you know, conducive to them. Plus they've got people coming and going all day poking at them and looking at them, and then you've got all the store noise. It's, to me, it's so stressful for those animals, and I wish they would take this farther and really ban anything that is fur or feathers from a pet store.
Thanks for that call, Cindy. And Mike, what's your response to that comment? I think it's probably pretty common.
Well, I certainly appreciate the thoughts and the feeling that go behind a position like that. But what we find is that, honestly, animals that are in pet stores actually do have a very high level of social interaction with people because of the traffic coming into the store. So they tend to be very well socialized. The nice thing about what you've got going currently in Wisconsin is that for the past 10 years, the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection has overseen all dog sellers, shelters, rescues, and pet stores alike, conducting unannounced inspections, making sure that any complaints are followed up on. You've actually got one of the most comprehensive sets of regulations in the country currently, and Wisconsin's to be applauded for that. The one thing that Wisconsin doesn't have currently in place, and this is something that we've actually attempted to bring to the sponsors' attention, is we'd love to see Wisconsin implement a statewide warranty, something that would allow for reimbursement veterinary bills in situations where animals have either a congenital or an illness that they've picked up from being in contact with other animals.
Thanks for that call. Let's go back to the phones, and Adam and Racina's up. Hi, Adam.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
So I actually am the owner of the Petland in Racine. So this issue touches us significantly. Because as Mike was saying, our whole business is about matching the right pet with the right family. So if suddenly the law is passed and we're unable to do that, our entire display space, our fixturing, all the stuff that is built around safely and comfortably housing these pets, there's no point of it. There's no use for it. The current Act 90, 2009's Act 90, that is the dog seller law that's in effect in Wisconsin, specifies the housing for adult dogs is different from nursery housing for puppies. So I have a brand new kennel. We just expanded our store in 2016, but those cages, that kind of housing, even though it's very nice and new and spacious for puppies, it wouldn't even be legal for adult dogs. Hmm.
Thanks so much for that call, Adam. And Adam, would you be able to continue in business if this goes into place on January 1st, as it would be if the bill is passed?
We would absolutely have to close.
All right. Thanks for that call. Let's go back to the phones, and Chris in Kenosha County is up. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just briefly, I just want to say, as someone who, I'm not a breeder, but I have bred one litter, a German Shepherd litter. I did the right things, health checks. I x-rayed my female, good hips. The male was x-rayed. I can, and knowing people in the business that are like reputable breeders, I can almost tell you without a doubt that a reputable breeder, someone that's health checking their litter, would almost never sell their litter through a pet store. That's just a point I just want to make. So I don't think that puppies that are sold through pet stores, commercial stores, they're not vetting people. The health checks, the clearances, they're not there. I can take the comment off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much for that, Chris. And actually, let's go immediately to Tara in Milwaukee for her perspective. Hi, Tara.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. So I agree with what Chris just said in regards of some of the differences between hobbyist breeders who participate in purpose-bred dog sports and pet stores. A pet store still has to vet check their puppies, but they may not be doing the same intensive screening with the adults that a hobbyist breeder might. We don't support purchasing puppies and dogs from pet stores. However, it's a slippery slope. If we say no pet stores because that's bad, then when do we start distinguishing the finer lines between bad and good, appropriate and inappropriate breeding practices? I think it's more important to work on educating the consumers on where to get a dog and what they should ask for and look for. And it's also important to make sure that the dogs that are produced, regardless of where they are sold, are properly screened for health clearances, same with the parents, getting the appropriate care and being placed appropriately in families where the correct breed with the correct family situation is going to be made.
Thanks for that call, Tara. And Mike, lots of perspectives there, pretty emotional reactions to this. And let's zero in on Adam and being a pet store owner. What would you say to
Sure.
someone who's probably going to lose his livelihood as a result?
Well, unfortunately, that's the reality of this, is that this is going to fall disproportionately on the pet store owners in Wisconsin whose businesses rely on those relationships in order to stay active. And that's going to cost jobs, and it's going to impact people in Wisconsin. It's not going to do anything to put, you know, the big bad breeders outside the state out of business the way the advocates might suggest, because unfortunately, you know, that's simply not the way the interaction works. That does not get passed back to the breeders because so few dogs are coming from breeders through pet stores.
So, Mike, you talk with legislators and other policymakers in a variety of states who have very good intentions in wanting to protect these animals. What advice do you give them on the best way to do that?
Well, we strongly advocate for legislation that prioritizes transparency, oversight, and education. And in Wisconsin right now, you all are doing a great job with transparency and oversight through the Department of Agriculture and through the efforts of everyone who's involved in vetting puppy sellers and dog sellers to make sure that they are being held to those high standards. I don't think a lot of people understand that those standards are already in place and being enforced, and I'd love to see more being done to improve education about that. And again, I think our thought is that because there are these regulations already on the books, rather than simply carving out one class of dog seller and saying, you know, you can no longer do this, you can no longer sell while everybody else can, I think it would be a much more responsible approach to sit down and say, what can we do with the laws that we've already got in place and with the interest in enforcement to make sure that everyone is matched with their ideal companion animal and that they've got the opportunity to be educated on the front end so that they make those lifelong connections and we don't have to worry about animals ending up in shelters in the first place.
Well, Mike, thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for the time.
That was Mike Bober, President and CEO of the Pet Industry Joint Advisory Council. We talked with him about how states are taking action against puppy mills by limiting pet sales in pet stores. Earlier, we spoke with Representative Lakeisha Myers. She's a Democrat from Wisconsin's 12th District and is the author of a bill in the Wisconsin legislature that would penalize pet stores for selling dogs and cats.
Still time for you to weigh in on this issue over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Do you support that kind of a legislation? Do you have concerns about it? What do you think would be the best way to guarantee the well-being of cats and dogs, however they're bred and sold in Wisconsin? Let us know what you think and maybe your firsthand experience over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. President Trump tweeted a message in advance of his reelection campaign launch this week saying that millions of people who are in the country illegally would be deported starting next week. Here's the president before his campaign rally Tuesday.
And they're going to start next week. And when people come into our country and they come in illegally, they have to go out.
Officials from the Department of Homeland Security raised questions about that number, telling the New York Times that millions of people could not be deported immediately. However, there have been signals from Immigration and Customs Enforcement staff in recent weeks that raids targeting thousands of migrants in their communities were on the way.
Elise Cohen is an immigration expert and associate professor of political science at UW Green Bay. Elise, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you.
Well, the president's tweet and statement signaled deportation of millions starting next week. It looks like that process will be much more scaled back, according to what we're hearing from immigration officials. What do we know?
Yeah, that was a tweet sent earlier in the week and got a lot of attention because of the number, because of the language of sort of mass deportation. But you're right, it's sort of been walked back a little. So, for example, yesterday, the acting ICE director, Mark Morgan, focused on some undocumented families who already have deportation orders. And that number that he's using now is around 2,000. So we're sort of moving from millions to thousands. And another thing to keep in mind, I guess, with Trump's tweet of deporting millions is that he didn't really specify a time window. So potentially that leaves the door open that this could be over the next, you know, year and a half or so that he would aim for constant increases in deportations.
You mentioned that ICE, the priority looks like a specific category of people who have already received deportation orders. Who would that be? What part of the process would they have gone through?
Yeah, that's a really good point to focus on. So the acting ICE director is talking about undocumented families, and this is a change from the previous administration. Under the Obama administration, the priority for deportations was particularly those that had committed criminal offenses. That priority structure is gone now with the Trump administration, and Mark Morgan is kind of doubling down on that, which previous directors had said as well, that it's not just those with a criminal record or violent offenses. It's really anyone that's here, and that includes family units. So this roughly 2,000 or so is part of a number of undocumented families that already had final deportation issues ordered, which means an immigration judge already ruled on their case. A lot of controversy surrounds that because their adjudication was expedited. Some of them claimed they didn't even know the court date had been moved up, or they were given the wrong court date by ICE officials, so they ended up missing their hearing and then were ruled deportable sort of in absentia. So there's a little bit of controversy surrounding that, but right now the ICE director is not really commenting on that part and saying, well, we're enforcing the law and those family units are going to be prioritized for removal.
And are these families, for the most part, that had come in and attempted to claim asylum status?
Yeah, that's another really important part of the conversation. Most of these migrants that are coming from the Central American countries, the sort of Northern Triangle countries, are here to claim asylum. They do claim that they're fleeing persecution, violence, harm, torture, a lot of extortion and threats made against families by gang members, for example, is widespread in these countries. For President Trump, we know in his own rhetoric that he views many of these claims as fraudulent, and he thinks that they're just trying to game the system. So he doesn't seem to put much stock in the notion of legitimate claims of asylum.
Talking to Elise Cohen from UW Green Bay about the president's latest comments on deportation and the latest on the situation with migrants coming from Central America up to the U.S. border. On a practical level, people have raised concerns about the ability of the United States to at least quickly deport millions of people in the course of weeks or months.
Yeah, so the logistical hurdles are really interesting to consider here. Some of those ICE officials that have spoken out, or, you know, previous ICE officials that used to work for the agency that have a little more flexibility to speak out, have said it's just not possible in practical terms. A lot of that is in terms of staffing. It seems like we are getting reports now that ICE is trying to get some agents, sort of borrow some agents from the Department of Homeland Security. Those are people that are probably typically not doing anything related to deportation, but maybe working on human trafficking organizations or something like that, asking to use them as part of this effort to have an increase in deportations in the coming weeks. There's also a detention aspect to this, where we are already at quote-unquote capacity in terms of congressionally allocated funds for detention facilities, actually over capacity. There's something like over 50,000 detainees in these migrant detention facilities, and the limit is like 40,000 or so. So you have those sort of staffing constraints, space constraints. Another thing to keep in mind is the legal constraints, right? It's the sort of due process that may be denied if these deportations are expedited, particularly if they try and go beyond those that already have final removal orders. We could see that just create more backlog in the immigration court system than there already is, with attorneys saying, well, that's not fair, that's violating some of the rights, so we're going to need to make a motion to reopen those deportation cases.
Where do we stand now in the United States when it comes to the rate at which we're deporting people, compared, for example, to the earlier years of the Obama administration, where people, immigration supporters, criticized him as the deporter in chief?
All right. That's a really great thing to remember. I think it's easy to forget with so much news happening every week, it seems. But it was President Obama who was called the deporter in chief. That was in part because he set a record for, I think it was fiscal year 2012, that he deported over 400,000 unauthorized migrants that year. And he also had some other controversial programs that contributed to that, like the Secure Communities program. What we see with the numbers just on an annual basis, because that's usually how they are offered, how they're provided, is, you know, maybe like 100 or 150,000 less than that has been the annual average in the first couple years of the Trump administration. One thing to keep in mind when you really start digging into the numbers, because I was looking at this earlier today, is filings for removal orders have really increased. So even though those physical deportations that we have the data on are still below that peak under Obama. We do see under the Trump administration a record high for the number of removal orders, kind of getting the deportation proceedings officially started in the immigration courts. So those have gone way up, you know, maybe by about 50,000 a year, more than we saw under the Obama administration.
And how do the numbers of people coming to the United States border from Mexico and of course, Central America compare now to that peak under the earlier years of the Obama administration, late years of the Bush administration?
Oh, yeah, that's some more great context with all these numbers. It's sort of interesting because we had seen the first year of the Trump presidency that the numbers were lower. But then what's happened in recent months is particularly families that are fleeing persecution, that are seeking asylum, are reaching new levels. So I think I saw the statistic that last month we had over 140,000 that were taken into custody along the southern border. And that is placed as the highest monthly total in about 13 years. So there really is something going on there. But we have to also be careful because there's sort of this constant language of like surging numbers and a crisis. And we see that year after year, the same kind of language of surging, flowing crisis levels of numbers. But you're right. There is something happening in the last few months, particularly with families. And that's a change from what we saw before.
Elise Cohen is with us from UW Green Bay talking about President Trump's recent statements about upcoming large-scale deportations.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you in favor of this move by the administration? Are you excited to hear this from the president as he launches his campaign for re-election? Or does this cause concern and fear in your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our look at possible large-scale deportations starting next week. The president is talking about millions of people potentially being deported. Enforcement officials are looking at numbers more in the thousands. UW Green Bay's Elise Cohen stays with us.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's your take on the rhetoric over immigration? How is it affecting your community? Is it on your mind as we look forward towards future policy moves and even future elections? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Elise, before we go to our callers, I've seen something a bit paradoxical. The number is increasing. Some people suggest because of a fear that the borders will be shut down. And I've seen reports, at least, that people who help smuggle people across Mexico and up to the border are saying, hey, go now before tougher constraints come in. And that might be part of why we're seeing bigger numbers this last couple of months. Is there anything to that?
Yeah, I've also seen those reports that particularly those that are maybe even a bit predatory trying to make money off of those journeys are telling them, you know, this is going to be your last chance because the window is closing. What you see is the rhetoric always shifts when the numbers are shifting. So sometimes when they go down, the administration officials may say, well, that's because what we're doing is working and we're deterring people from coming. And then when you see the numbers go up, you see this language of, oh, you see, it is a crisis. And that's why we have to take unprecedented steps. So it's always a little bit tricky when we're in the middle of it to pinpoint exactly what's going on in terms of driving those numbers. But we know the violence is the constant in terms of why the people would be fleeing in such large numbers from those Central American countries.
Let's bring on a caller now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Charlie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I believe strongly in legal immigration, but not illegal immigration. And I believe that our borders should be strong, but we need to have our laws reflect the fact that it is the United States drug use that is fueling so much instability in the southern in these countries and is leading to the illegal immigration. We have to recognize that our drug use is really the primary cause for this violence, and we need to stop that now.
Charlie, thanks for the call. So American demand for drugs destabilizing countries that either are the source of the drugs or part of the pipeline for the flow of drugs, Elise, he says.
Yeah, that's a really good point that Charlie, the caller, is making there in terms of what sort of pull factors would be, bringing some of the gang activity and the violence into those border communities. And he's absolutely right that, most of this, in terms of supply and demand, it is a U.S.-based demand for those drugs. So where we do see that intensified drug-related criminal activity, a lot of that is surrounding our own demand for those drugs to kind of come in and fuel that violence, particularly even in Central America, where we sort of pushed south what we had seen previously in Mexico. A lot of that is still being fueled by that trafficking into the U.S. for meeting our own demand.
Charlie, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Elizabeth in Duluth. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering if the policies that were carried out in Honduras and Nicaragua by Negroponte under a number of presidents had any effect on this mass exodus to the United States.
Elizabeth, thanks. American foreign policy and how it affected the countries that are the source of so much of this migration, Elise.
Yeah, another really great point. Elizabeth is absolutely right. There's a lot of wonderful history that people can read, some great books written on our U.S. foreign policy during the Cold War, and many of the current conditions of violence and particularly corruption that we see in those Central American, quote-unquote, Northern Triangle countries are a result of decades of U.S. foreign policy where we were either propping up certain dictators in terms of fighting against communism, but then really brutally undoing the legitimacy of the institutions and the legal system in those countries. So there's a legacy effect that's still there today. Perhaps we were even directly arming and fueling some of those groups that were fighting on our behalf. And so we still see large-scale circulation of weapons and violence as a result of those foreign policies. So, yeah, it's a great point to think about, how might there be obligations that stem from our own sort of culpable foreign policies in the region.
Thanks for that call, Elizabeth. Elise, I want to spend our last minute and a half or so on American politics and immigration. We saw candidate Donald Trump originally make his big announcement focusing on immigration, talking about Mexicans in particular. Now, the same week he has his official campaign rally kickoff, he talks about deporting millions. Can you talk about how this fits into the 2020 elections?
Yeah, that's a really great way to end. Absolutely, we can see this in the framework of partisan competition and his 2020 election campaign messaging. If we look to see what he was saying as he kicked off his campaign, he used the language of, "I will be keeping my promises to the American people." And immediately following his election in 2016, he did promise to deport, quote, millions of what he then called criminal aliens. And he said he promised he would deport maybe even up to 3 million. And so if we want to look at that language of fulfilling promises, we can trace that right back to some of the things he said he would do. He also praised mass deportation way back in November 2015 in one of those Republican presidential primary debates under Eisenhower, sort of the largest deportation we saw, called the very derogatory terminology of Operation Wetback. But Trump, when he was a candidate, praised that for deporting over 1 million people. So we can kind of see this playing very nicely into shoring up support among his base and painting the Democrats as really being against border security.
Elise, we'll check in with you again before long, I'm sure. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
Elise Cohen is an immigration expert and associate professor of political science at UW Green Bay. She joined us for a look at the president's statement that there would be mass deportations starting next week. Let us know what you think. If this is something that affects you or your community, you can email us ideas@WPR.org. The Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection issued more than 1,300 licenses to grow industrial hemp this year, a 22% increase from last year. But some producers who grew the new crop back in 2018 say they no longer think it's a simple solution to farmers' financial woes. WPR's Hope Kerwin has more.
Last spring, LaVon Felton was all in when it came to industrial hemp. Felton owns car dealerships in Viroqua, and he has an organic farm outside of town. In 2018, he had a contract to grow 48 acres of hemp grain for Legacy Hemp, a company out of North Dakota. On a sunny day in May, he took his best guess on how to plant the newly approved crop.
So I'm going to start at a wheat setting at 40 pounds an acre, and then I'll adjust as needed. So we're just going to fill up the grain drill.
Even though hemp grain had never been grown in Wisconsin, Felton believed it could help farmers struggling with low prices for traditional commodities like milk and corn. Looking back now, he says the lack of information wasn't his biggest obstacle. It was simply the persistent rains that impacted fields across the state.
You know, it just couldn't get dried out. It just rained a lot. So when we did get it harvested, we came up with a good product, but it tested too high for mold spores in the grain.
Felton didn't sell a single pound of the hemp grain he harvested in 2018, and neither did the roughly 20 other farmers who contracted with Legacy Hemp. Between the seed, fertilizer, required testing, and other expenses, Felton estimates the endeavor cost him at least $20,000. And he wants farmers planting hemp this year to know they're taking a risk.
At least if we have a corn crop that doesn't go well or beans, we're going to get something. You know, we're going to be able to recoup some of our costs. You know, basically with this, if you lose it, you lose it all.
Corn and soybeans with small amounts of mold can still be sold for livestock feed. But the only market for hemp grain is for human consumption. So Felton says he doesn't think growing hemp grain will ever be profitable in Wisconsin because of the climate. The state doesn't have the same arid summers as plain states like North Dakota, where hemp grain has been grown since 2016. And Legacy Hemp agronomist Brian Parr says his company is starting to agree, especially if Wisconsin continues to see frequent heavy rain events at the end of summer.
If it's not going to be conducive in Wisconsin because of our changing climate, then it may not be the best crop to be growing in Wisconsin for grain.
Parr says the state's farmers have a much better shot in the hemp fiber market and the rapidly expanding wellness industry around cannabidiol oil, or CBD. But growing hemp for CBD products has had its own problems. Just ask Bob Povelmacher, who farms part-time near Lone Rock. Povelmacher planted 3 acres of hemp for CBD in 2018 and harvested around 1,000 pounds of hemp buds with a fairly high percentage of CBD. At the current market rate, Povelmacher should get around $450 per pound for the buds. But he can't find enough buyers.
I've got a bunch of different shops that are buying it, but they're only a pound or 2 pounds at a time. So it's pretty slow. I mean, it's steady, but it's slow.
Povelmacher says the larger CBD manufacturers he's contacted already have more than enough hemp. So he's having to work harder to market his product. He's even invested in lab equipment so he can make a hemp extract on his farm, a less processed version of CBD oil. And he is optimistic the market is catching up. This year, DATCAP issued 600 processor licenses, 100 more than last year. Povelmacher says adding industrial hemp to his farm has not been easy, but he says the risks around the new crop are no different than the gamble every farmer takes when planting a field.
This is just another facet of the business. You know, it's another crop, and hopefully this one works and the other ones will come around and one of those will work some other year.
He's taking another chance on industrial hemp this year and helping a group of local farmers grow about 10 acres of hemp for CBD. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the U.S. Supreme Court is expected to rule on a handful of high-profile cases over the next few weeks, from gerrymandering and whether laws apply to district lines drawn on partisan grounds, and workplace discrimination against members of the LGBT community. We'll find out what's at stake on those and other key cases.
Fewer kids are riding bikes these days, and health advocates say that's not good news. Our guest gives us the story behind those numbers.
And it's this week's edition of Food Friday, and we'll celebrate celery. Now, that's not something that everybody likes, but if you think you don't like it, we've got some twists and surprises for you. Celery in bread. Lori Skelton's going to be on. She made some celery bread. Pretty good. Celery in desserts. Jury's out. And celery in drinks, which I have not tried, but I'm hearing great things from all the people
celery.
For the youth.
When she suggested celery, I was all in for celery.
That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.